horses have four gaits, right?
Correct.
Four gaits. So there's the walk, which we've all seen. That's normal. Then we have the trot, which is the second one.
Correct.
And then we have the canter.
Yep.
Which is what's the difference between a canter and a gallop then?
It's three paces and it's slower than a gallop. So gallop is they're using their feet coming out. So you get in canter, you get first foot, two back feet, next front foot.
Got it.
You get four, one, two, three, four. That makes sense. So it's much better.
And the gallop is basically the gait where all 4 feet are off the floor.
Correct.
At one time, isn't it?
You're like a dictionary. You pretend to be stupid, but you know a load of stuff.
You know what? I'm actually really interested in different ways that animals move. This sounds really stupid, right? But the reality is there's all kinds of, and the scientific names for how these animals move. Like, did you know, for instance, that gibbons, you know, a gibbon?
Yeah.
They brachiate. They brachiate through a swing with your arms through our arboreal environment. So, if you're swinging like not Tarzan, doesn't use a rope, but if you're swinging arm to arm like that, you're brachiating. And that is a method of locomotion. And in fact, the gibbons are one of the fastest moving creatures that way, because you know the speed in which they swing, the momentum they generate is incredible. So yeah, we're talking about motion and how animals move, folks. Very, very interesting. Much more interesting than recruiting. However, we're gonna switch to recruiting because it's Brain Food Live on Air, folks, bringing it to you every Friday nonstop. It's episode 104, and we've got a very exciting show for you today. We're talking about RPOs, how to work with them, how not to work with them, how to get the best out of them. And in fact, what do RPOs want? Because let's face it, without a partnership and a win-win, everyone's going to be lose-lose. So we've got a very exciting show today. We're going to speak from people who've used RPOs, are RPOs, essentially trying to distill, is there a method to do this? Because I think if you're in recruiting and this is your career path, the chances are it's going to be one of those things that you're going to have to learn how to do at one point. So, you know, no matter where you're sitting right now, at some stage you may find yourself in a scenario where, you know what, you have to do something and bring in a partner. This is stuff you need to know. Anyway, before we kick off, a bit of a sound check as we usually do. We are now broadcasting on Crowdcast. I think you can hear me up. Yes, people are talking about gates. That's fine. They can totally hear me on Crowdcast. That's okay. Thank you, Maury. We are multicasting on LinkedIn, though. So if you can hear me on LinkedIn, you're watching this live now, can you please give me a shout and say yes? I can hear you, Hung. I don't think we're on live on LinkedIn, you know. Always problems. But if you can hear me, please say so. And if we're on Facebook in the group, if you can hear me, just give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And that would be really nice to know. Okay, I think we're getting some signals that we're okay. Actually, LinkedIn seems to be fine. It always panics me. I'm trying to broadcast. It's a blank screen. It's like it's empty. What's going on? Who knows? All right. So it seems that we're going good. All right. Quick word to our sponsors today, Kelly Services, one of the biggest businesses in the recruiting space. Essentially, you know, it's the ultra toolbox. Whatever you want, you can get out of Kelly Services. Check them out, kellyservices.com. They are a business, I think, if you are enterprise scale of any type and you need something. Internal talent mobility support, third-party sort of software recommendation, some team to parachute in to help you out. Kelly Services are the business you need to check out. Okay, cool. Let's get on with the show. I'm excited today because I have finally managed to upgrade Adam Gordon again. Yes, he's been here too many times. We've got him upgraded to Alison Ettridge. Alison, how are you doing? Good to see you.
I'm very good, and thanks very much. I'm not so sure about the upgrade, but it's lovely to walk a step in Adam's shoes for a week.
I think we just have to run a quick straw poll in the audience. Is Alison an upgrade on Adam Gordon? It's like all the thumbs are going to go up. Alison, your job is always to talk about what happened to the newsletter last week. So what happened on the newsletter? Was there anything interesting, and did you read it?
Yes, I had to, because I suddenly had to step in Adam's shoes. So I had to anyway, but I always read it. But for me, there were, I think, three or four really interesting articles. So the first was from Brené Brown, which was talking about how much vulnerability should you have at work, and how much is too much. And I just thought the whole article was fascinating, actually.
Wow, this is interesting, isn't it? Folks, I've just shared it in the link in the crowd stream there. But basically, it is Brené Brown. She's such a hero, by the way. I'm a late arriver to Brené Brown, right? But everyone I speak to just rates her amazing, massively. So I'm going to read her books and I'm going to get into her TED Talks and stuff like this. But she actually was talking about something I think we're all intuitively feeling a little bit. Because whilst we think vulnerability is a good thing, 100%, we need to get beyond the stiff upper lip world. There's no question about that. But how much is too much? Are we oversharing, folks? And what did she say? Was there a line? Like, did she help us with that?
There were two. So she's got one line which she put into six words, which was vulnerability minus boundaries is not vulnerability, which I thought was quite cool. But then she explained it a little bit better in the rest of the blog, which is, actually, our colleagues are there to help us accomplish great things together. And so you should be genuine, but actually you shouldn't be seeing your colleagues as a place where you dump your emotions.
That's right. And in fact, she cited an example, didn't she, where essentially she was advising this founding team, and the founding team were about to charge out and say, yeah, I've got this going on. And she said, no, don't share that, because it might actually damage how people perceive you in this right now, this circumstance. And what do you hope to achieve by sharing this? It probably is not going to create, it won't sort of strengthen any relationships. It might just lay a bit of pressure on the team that you're meant to be insulating. So
you've got to be a leader, right? Yeah, you've got to be genuine, but at some point you've still got to be a leader. And that, I think, was what was really interesting when I read that article.
You know what? I want to explore this in more depth. I think this is a really important topic, especially for leaders, because is there a slightly different standard that a leader has to adopt with regards to vulnerability? Because I think you do need vulnerability to create relationships, but you have a wider responsibility beyond your own needs sometimes, don't you? You've got to care about your customers. You've got to care about your stakeholders, your investors maybe, or your staff as well. So, yeah, fascinating one. Love to hear what you think about this one, by the way, guys. Give me another one, Alison.
No, so the Alan Turing Institute put out actually a really good report. It's worth downloading and reading it in more detail. Mm-hmm. But it talks about where are the women and mapping the gender job gap in data science and AI.
Yes.
And there were a couple of things that I think were interesting for me. So one, I'm biased. It says that there's little data available. And I just felt like jumping up and down again. There's shed loads of data available about the gender gap in data science and AI. So yeah, we simply believe that piece wasn't true. But actually, there were some things that came out that were really interesting. So they were looking at early careers talent moving through and the flow of talent and what happens to females in data science and in AI. They were talking, they brought up the confidence issue in women generally, and their
confidence in women or confidence
in a woman rather right. than confidence in women, sorry, yes, as a generalization. But they were talking therefore about how a lack of confidence in some women means that they're not participating in a whole bunch of the online groups. They're not putting particular skills on their profiles or shouting out about their profiles, which I thought was interesting. And actually, it got me wondering whether it was a lack of confidence or a lack of time, which I thought was quite interesting. Yep. But the biggie for me in all of this was, and it's the first time I've sat back and looked at it, because I thought, yeah, we've got all this data. There's no question that the data is there. But it's actually, what is the wider impact? You know, if Facebook and Google only have 10 or 15% of their teams who are working on data science and AI, what's the wider impact in terms of the bias of thinking through that lack of diversity, whether it's gender, whether it's race, whether it's background, whatever. So I thought that was a really, really interesting article.
It is indeed, and must read, folks. It's very accessible. I know sometimes we think about AI and it's like, oh my goodness, too much for us to compute. But this one is written with layperson in mind. I could read it and understand it. So definitely worth exploring. And even the key summary I thought was sometimes very useful. Bullet points about what the issue is as is, and gives you some guidance as to what might do about it. I think you're absolutely right, though, Alison, with how significant AI is as a transformative technology, if you will, you know, will affect every other bit of technology. Critically important, we get a cross-section of the human population doing it, because otherwise, you know, we're going to create defaults that are going to be problematic for a lot of people. So yeah, really interesting to read. One more, Alison.
Okay, so the next one I'm going to pick then is, there was an article about improving hiring results by increasing transparency of the recruitment process. And so this was particularly looking through the candidate's eyes and talking about, yes, the fact that, you know, we are all thinking about candidate experience. Actually, it'd be great to hear more about this through this discussion as we're talking to Kelly. But it was about being completely transparent over the recruitment process at every single stage with candidates. And there were some really interesting points. So the first for me was that it was by a chap called Dr. John Sullivan, who's US based. And he was talking about the first time for the Securities Exchange Commission has said that large US global corporates have now got to give data and analytics on their people and their metrics. So that for me was interesting because it means that we're really elevating the whole process of talent acquisition to a strategic level and reporting on metrics and understanding things through the lens of the candidate. So yeah, I thought it was just a really interesting article that means that other people are looking at it.
You know, Dr. John Sullivan has been in the business for like ages, you know, decades on, and he suddenly got a burst of energy somehow. Do you know what I mean? Because he kind of slowed down a lot. I always read his stuff, but he sort of slowed down, understandably so, given, you know, he really has contributed so much already. But suddenly he's coming out with these like weekly posts. And I think you've got to really check out, you know, drjohnsullivan.com again. Really interesting, set of thinking. And his production and his quality is right back up there again. So definitely check that out. Okay, fantastic. Where is Simon? Simon said, where is Adam today? Adam's been fired. He's been fired from Brain Food Lab. No, he hasn't. He's on a mountain somewhere with his boy. I think he's on a ridiculous trek, which I don't think he's going to manage, to be honest. He's well overweight. And he's going up this mountain and coming back down. And I'm thinking, yeah, that's a disaster waiting to happen. Anyway, good luck to Gordon. So his boy's going to have to carry him home.
It'll be fine.
All right, let's talk about this topic. RPOs. Alison, I don't know whether you know anything about it. I'm super ignorant of RPOs. Generally speaking, back in my day, the only time people were working with RPOs were essentially big banks that oftentimes would say, right, we're not doing any TA at all. We're going to get, you know, Alexander Manning or whoever it is, some big company come in, just outsource the entire lot. Whilst that's still a big part of what RPOs do, we're starting to see this model appear in much smaller packets now, aren't we? And the startups are starting to get them in, and sometimes it's like a partnership that comes in and out. So lots of interesting new formulas coming into this world. Have you any experience with RPO at all, Alison?
No, I'm really excited about this one because I think you're a bit like you, kind of in the olden days. Yeah, it was really big companies doing big outsourcing, and I think there's a more flexible and agile model that's emerged. And yeah, I'm super excited to hear more about it.
Let's bring on some experts then, shall we? We're going to bring on, firstly, Richard Bradley, who, he doesn't like me saying this, but I think he might actually be the most intelligent man in recruiting.
Wow.
I think so.
I'm feeling sorry for Richard already.
Intimidating you. So, and I'm also going to bring on Melanie Forbes. Melanie, who works for EBSCO, I think. Oh, I can't find her. There she is. Cool, Mel Forbes. And then hopefully they're going to educate us on what RPO is all about. Whilst we're talking, folks, I'm just interested to know, I mean, have you worked with an RPO? Like, what's your experience of this model? Have you actually brought an RPO into your business at any time. There he is, Richard Bradley. How are you doing, sir?
I'm very well, thank you, Han. Great to hear from you.
Good to see you. Rich, for the people who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself to the crowd? Who are you and what it is you do?
Hi, I'm Richard Bradley. I look after the Kelly Services RPO business across EMEA. So that's me. Been in the industry, staffing, recruiting, RPO in-house for about 25 years. Hard to believe. I know I only look about 12, but yeah, I've been around for a while. Not been found out yet either.
Amazing. You managed to just beat that imposter syndrome away for like 30 years. That's fantastic, Rich.
Pretty much.
No, great to have you on the show. And Mel, thank you so much for joining us also. Mel Forbes, for the people who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself, who it is you are and what it is you do, Mel?
So, like Richard, I've been in the industry now for 30 years in outsourcing for probably just over 20 of those. Like Richard, I started when I was only 10 in the industry. It was like, you know, child labour. And I've recently joined APSCO Outsource, is a new trade body representing the outsourcing sector. In fact, we're the first trade body in the whole world to represent the outsourcing sector. So it's very exciting.
Fantastic. And that's really interesting to know, because I didn't realize a body existed of this type. But rightly so, because it is a different type of recruiting business, isn't it? So let's just take this all the way back to the brass tacks, because there might be some people that don't understand this model. But so we all understand in-house, we all understand third-party agency, but an RPO is what exactly? You first, Rich.
Yeah, what's an RPO? I think you kind of summed it up earlier, Hung. It was like it's an evolution of a delivery model, basically. You know, if you look at, you know, if you look back in the day, there weren't really talent acquisition teams. It was done by HR departments, and you had staffing agencies, and then, you know, it suddenly became a little bit more sophisticated, and people were going, hang on a minute, bringing people into the organization is really important. And we saw the development of in-house functions and talent acquisition, and it's developed. And then the staffing model changed, and there's, you know, a lot of fighting between Rosaline and Jeremy Tipper about who came up with the concept of RPO. But it really was, you know, could we take the best of recruitment agencies and what a recruitment agency do, and kind of do it on behalf of companies that aren't set up to do that? And that's where the concept originally came from. And it's evolved to the point today where, you know, I would say that if you look at it, you know, without getting all statistical, about 64% of those people that engage in RPO today are not actually engaging end to end. They're looking at a modular service and buying in expertise. And for me, what is RPO today? It's about collaboration. It's about bringing in the skills or experience that you need when you need it to supplement and effectively make your TA function absolutely sing and dance. And it can be different things. And this is really important. It can be different things to different organizations and different people. It's really varied. So like a politician, I've not really answered the question. I've kind of scattergunned around the area. But
you sounded really clever though, Richard. And Hung said you're the cleverest man in recruitment, and that's
how Richard does it, by the way, folks. You know, he just speaks eloquently at length and closes the. It's like, all right, I agree, Richard. That's the only response you've got. Yes, Rich, you're right. Listen, you said some interesting things. I'm gonna go to Mel next, but one thing I need to remember is that you said that actually a lot of RPO purchasing is modular, not wholesale, which surprised me, actually, because I thought RPO outsourced the entire lot. Isn't that the idea? But let's go back to that at some point during the course of this chat. Mel, let's go to you. You're working for an organization that represents RPOs. So I presume RPOs have an identity of them as being separate to in-house an agency. So what's the conversation like in that community of businesses?
Well, I think it's, to Rich's point, it has evolved. There's so many different types of models. So what I'm finding is, whereas you would consider any form of outsourcing, it's either outsourcing permanent recruitment or outsourcing contingent recruitment. Actually, there's so many different flavors of that. So different organizations, my members, do very different things. So some organisations only do what Richard's referring to, is that modular base. So very much what we can call project RPO or RPO on demand. So this just allows companies to switch it on and off. So when you talk about going back to the early days where it was wholesale, you know, banks was a good example where they would just outsource the whole lot. They didn't want an internal team at all. And then you move to sort of more of a hybrid. And then you move to this situation where you had organizations who had a big project coming up, which would have overloaded their internal team. So they outsourced that element of it. It might only be 50 hires, it could be 150 hires, but whatever. But I think then when you blend in the fact that companies outsource, then they in-house, then they outsource, then they in-house, it goes in a cycle. And then you've got all the tech that's coming downstream, some amazing platforms that do all sorts of parts of the outsourcing modules, to your point, Rich. So now what you've got is a company might go, right, we'll use an application to do those parts of the process. We'll have our own team doing this part of the process, and then we'll outsource the back end totally to another organization. So that's why you've ended up with loads and loads of different options, very, very flexible models.
This is really interesting to me. I can see it's interesting for Alison as well. Like, we're the dumbasses on this, by the way. So we're describing new things. Yeah, Alison's learning as we speak. With regards to, like, I just assumed that maybe this is just me snapshotting it from the last time I was in the agency game, that it would, the wholesale, let's take it away from this customer, would still be the dominant model. Now, do companies still do that? And what is the general percentage of businesses that want to just get rid of recruiting, let's say, and yeah, we're just going to ship this long-term multi-year contract. This company's going to sit in and do it for us. Is that still a big part of the RPO business, or how does it look in comparison to the modular side?
So maybe I'll go first. I mean, I think again, the market's evolved, and I think the really cool thing is that, you know, 15, 20 years ago, talent acquisition wasn't considered particularly strategic. It just wasn't, you know. And for those that are in HR, I apologize for the comment I'm about to make. You know, we've heard so much about HR getting a seat at the table. Well, I think talent acquisition are leapfrogging you, because, you know, a lot of people in talent acquisition are now being able to use data and insight and be able to talk about the impact that the hiring function has in an organization. So the long-winded answer, Hung, is I think people do in some instances outsource and continue to outsource in big chunks, and for some organizations is absolutely the right thing to do. Whether that's you're a large enterprise and, you know, you need some consistency across 4 or 5 different geographical regions, and you need some consistency, and you need to be able to have that level. What you're finding is, even with RPOs, the strategic thinking, the head of talent acquisition normally still sits within that organization. So it's very much about collaboration. It's about not necessarily losing control of your talent acquisition function. What we're finding as well is, particularly in smaller organizations, and, you know, we've seen a massive rise at Kelly with people that are coming in from venture capitalists, or if they've got rounds of funding where they're going, you know, for you guys, this might not seem huge, but we've got to hire 60 people this year. And how are we going to hire those 60 people? You know, but that's still strategically important for that organization. So you're seeing different people buying at different levels. But yeah, it's a strategic decision. And yes, people are still outsourcing the whole kit and caboodle, but more and more of it is being more modular services, or big organizations maybe do it with IT, but not with finance. So again, you're seeing that evolve, and the way that people use RPO has changed immensely. It's not necessarily one size fits all.
Alison, you want to say something in a bit, so I'm going to let you in. But before I do that, I just want to say to Rich, what kind of companies then typically do outsource the job lot? Is there a category you can say, yeah, construction, they want to get rid of it. Is there a type of company that does this? Like, is there a pattern we can spot?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think if you look at the maturity of RPO, we've talked about predominantly the likes of financial services, that they were early adopters. So a lot of those organizations have gone down the whole RPO extensively out kit and caboodle. Starting to see the same in IT outsourcing, starting to see a lot of it in life sciences for some of their non-scientific areas. But you're seeing some of that. But one of the biggest things that I would say is if it's more than one country or perhaps maybe more than one region. So let's say, for example, it tends to be if it was just Germany or the UK and it's just one part of a large organization, we tend to find that they may look at more of a modular approach. What we would say is if you're seeing as somebody that maybe wants somebody in the US, somebody in the UK, somebody in Germany, they may look to outsource to a wider, larger provider. And to be fair, that plays to the strength of some of the providers like the AMSs and the Celeos in this world that do a great job in looking at those big multicultural bids.
Yeah, go ahead, Alison.
Yeah, I'm really interested in this because I kind of had this perception that enterprise RPO was in big enterprise, right? And that's kind of what happened. And it was a genuine outsourcing. And then I knew that we'd become more flexible and hybrid related, and that was probably for businesses that were scaling up. But we're talking about company size, and that feels like it's the wrong thing to be talking about. So how does a company know when it's the right time for them to be thinking about bringing in RPO as a solution, whether that's project or modular or kind of big stuff? You know, what are the kind of trigger points for them? You talked about, you know, regions. What are the other trigger points that they should be thinking about?
Well, I think for a customer, I think it will always come down to what problem are they trying to fix?
Yeah.
So you have to go back to what is it? And some organizations, when they might be trying to fix a particular D&I issue, so they might be trying to attract, let's use gender, they might want to attract more women into a certain part of their business, which you were touching on earlier, Alison. You've got to remember that although recruitment companies get a good old bashing, we are the experts at recruitment. So whilst a lot of those experts have moved into big organisations to set up their own talent acquisition operations, which is why things come in-house and out-house, the recruitment sector is still the experts. So fundamentally, organisations, if they were trying to fix that particular problem, they might decide to outsource that in order to fix that. Or it could be, to Richard's point around building a talent acquisition strategy, well, I need expertise from outside to come in and advise me. It might even be, I want to build a new centre of excellence in Hull. Is that the right place to build it? Or should I be building it in Sunderland? You know, where do I go for that talent? And again, being the experts, you know, organizations out there can come to a company and go, we've analyzed all of the hotspots for these types of talent, this is where you need to do it, and we'll set the whole thing up for you. So I think with the reason I've probably stayed in recruitment for 30 odd years is because it is about fixing problems, and that's what attracted me to the industry and why I've stayed in it for so long. But I think sometimes we think talent and less about the customer's issue. What are they trying to fix?
You know what, Mel, that's a brilliant response, because the problem orientation and just monitoring the chat sort of in the stream there, that may be the primary trigger, right? So there may be, let's say, an unprecedented, unexpected scenario. I think Naveen is talking about the vaccine situation, classic RPO scenario, right? You got to create all these vaccines. No pharmaceutical business has any capability to do at this type of scale. They probably have employed RPOs to come in to help them with that, because it's easier to get sort of ready to go delivery function than to grow your own delivery function from scratch. So maybe the emergency aspect of it is still a big component of what RPO is all about.
I think that's much more on the MSP side, Rich, don't you? I think it does. RPO, in my view, tends to be a longer plan. I know sometimes there's an unprecedented situation which demands it, but permanent recruitment tends to be a longer cycle. I think managed solution program. So the difference being RPO in my mind is permanent recruitment and MSP is contingent hiring. So as an example of that, in response to the pandemic, the government framework, which roughly before the pandemic was around 14,000 contingent workers across government, the last count is up to 21,000 contingent workers across the whole of government right now. That's a big old program.
Yeah,
so that's a direct response.
Yeah, I think there is a place, and I'll answer that question first, Mel, then come back to your original question, Hung. I think there is a place. You know, we have two programs today where organizations are going out with a vaccine and they need to staff up permanently, and it's like a bell curve. If you think about what we see on demand as a bell curve, you know, and your TA team, if you put a line across that, can deal with business as usual. You suddenly have a spike, what do you do? Historically, old school, you go to recruitment agencies. And this is why RPO gets quite a lot of bad press sometimes from recruitment agencies. And I sit with one camp in a staffing business and one camp in an RPO, and there's room for both. But you have that spike. Traditionally, you might have gone to a recruitment agency. Now you can buy in a team that collaborates with you, goes to market as your organization, and then completes that spike. That spike goes away, and you pull them out. That's our business model at Kelly, and it works really, really well. But to your original point, why do people come? Capacity, people just don't have the capacity when I've talked about the bell curve, or capability. And that's not saying that people aren't capable of doing the job, but it might be that they're going into a new market, or, you know, that they're having particular problems in IT, or maybe in research and development in a life sciences organization. They need to bring in expertise in that area. But more and more, what we're seeing is access to technology and tools, particularly within some of the smaller markets. So, you know, we had a very large automotive organization come out into the RPO world. And one of the big things that they were saying is that we want access to all of these really cool tools, but we can't actually afford to go out and buy each and every tool that you could potentially have access to, because that's my entire TA budget gone. You know, do RPOs necessarily have access to some of the tools and tech? And because we might be deploying it for 15 companies rather than one, do we then therefore able to offer economies of scale? So that's another area I think RPOs are getting to be able to help more and more with, was helping with a tech stack, being able to give access to tools, technologies, different ways of doing it. And one of the big fundamental things that we've really, really seen is a lot of TA functions, and I'm generalizing here, so I know I'm going to get shut down. A lot of TA functions are set up to deliver what I call reactive hiring. You have a job, you advertise a job, you manage that vacancy, you deal with it. And what we're seeing is talent is getting harder and harder to find talent, but it wants to be engaged with in a much more sophisticated way, coming back to candidate experience. So what we're seeing is a lot of what I would say our team are doing, it's almost like it's a rent an executive research recruitment business, because what happens is people want us to go and find passive talent. And that's where they bolt on the likes of Kelly quite a lot, in particularly in Europe, not so much in the States, but certainly in Europe. They're bolting us on to go out and find the passive talent, to go out and engage with people in a slightly different way from the traditional put out a job, look at your referral networks. It's about that blend. And that's why I talk about it being about being collaborative, because I think you can do different bits, can play different parts. And sometimes an RPO might go in and do the more reactive part to allow the people that really understand the business to go out and do the proactive part. But it's, the fact is, TA teams, I feel, are being asked to do so much more. It's like, it's like, oh, we know you used to do this, but now you can do this. Can you do this as well? Can you do this as well? But we're not increasing your budget. We're not increasing your headcount. And if anything, you've had COVID, so we've decided that we're going to let half the marketing department go and quite a few people in talent acquisition. But don't worry, we've got another 1,000 hires we need you to make when things pick up. But you'll be all right doing it as you do currently. It's just done an unsustainable model. And that's why I think the concept of RPO and the concept particularly of modular RPO is growing in popularity, because people are sat there going, how can I deliver what the client needs without necessarily paying 20, 30% to a recruitment agency to find 15, 20, 30, 100 hires? And that's why it's becoming really popular.
Can I ask a question about that? Because I think that's really interesting. So, you know, I've lived in a world of proactive hiring and talent intelligence for the last 15 years. And it's really refreshing hearing this from an RPO business. But yeah, genuinely speaking, how many RPO businesses are retained by an organization to build them proactive pools of talent versus being retained by an organization to put 1,000 bums on seats?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. So, you know, where we first started doing this, I don't like the term talent pools, because pools get stagnant. We talk about communities, and communities is about engagement and looking at that. You know, when I worked at AMS for a while, we did a big piece for one of the big banks, and it was fascinating. It was the first time I'd ever experienced an organization paying us quite a large amount of money to not hire anybody. And we had a team, I think it was either 6 or 8 people, and we had a list of the job critical roles that organization had and where would that potentially lead to if this person disappeared from our organization and the time to fill that person was 6 months, how much would that cost us? So we were literally engaging with people and saying, look, you may not necessarily want to look for an opportunity right now, but can we talk to you? And we would engage with them. We'd start drip feeding things in. We'd enjoy coffee time. And one of the first assignments we had when I joined Kelly actually was with a life sciences company for exactly the same reason. They had one person that works in rare diseases. The last time that person was out of the business, it took them 2 years to recruit them, and they were losing £5.5 million a year in research. So paying us what we thought was quite a decent amount of money, to be fair, was a drop in the ocean for them. They still haven't recruited, but they now actually know every person globally that can do that role. And we're in conversation and we're dropping information about that organization to them. And if that literally cuts their half, you know, if that cut their time to hire by 50%, it saved them £5 million. And that's how there's a lot more business cases, a lot more. Can you give me a business case of why we should come out to a modular RPO? Why should we use RPOs in this way? And it's being seen again much more strategically. And I think that's kind of where it's starting to work really, really well.
That's fascinating, Rich, particularly with regards to this strategic planning. I think you're right. As kind of operational recruiter, you may be asked to do that. But if you've got a headcount target and you've got to hit that, you're on this monthly cycle, typically, you don't deliver. You know what? You're not going to be spending time having, you know, your virtual coffees with people on speculative individuals that aren't going to enter your pipeline. So it's a different sort of rhythm of business. And if you can afford to have, you know, deep research teams carrying in your TA teams, then great. But oftentimes you don't have that, in which case getting it outsourced may be a quick solution there. Go to you, Mel, on a final question. I want to bring on John and Charlotte shortly. But I want to talk about remote on this. How is the shift to remote distributed working, etc.? Has that changed the conversation in the RPO world in any way? And if so, how? And if not, why not?
So do you mean in terms of, is it changed the way that they're doing it?
Has it changed the opportunity, I guess, in the sense that, you know, are companies behaving differently? Are people coming to you, your members with different requirements or not, as the case may be? You know, I'd be interested to know your market-wide perspective on that.
So I think when the pandemic initially hit, I don't know whether Rich saw this as well, there was an initial freeze of the market. So on the permanent side, everybody just stopped hiring. It was like this huge fear. Coming out of that, it's bounced back considerably well, if not, you know, some of the vacancy levels I'm seeing is higher than pre-pandemic because people went on hold for a period of time and now they're, you know, recruiting a lot of people. A lot of organisations, particularly the bigger organisations that you were referring to, were already very much, their TA functions were very much already remote. So that wasn't really a step change. Talking about, Richard, you know, the communities that you create as part of the RPO function, again, that was very much already in place. So that none of that needed to change. And there's some really cool tech out there that now does a lot of the work that previously was very manual, very much people orientated. Now it's very much you set it up on the system. So to your point, Rich, the pool doesn't become stagnant. It stays fresh all the time because it's a push and pull effect on the tech. So again, Hung, those things were already in place. I don't know whether, Rich, whether you've seen any, I haven't heard any significant changes that have happened in the market. Have you heard anything?
I think the biggest thing for me is workforce planning. It's something that still to this day amazes me. I mean, I'm not the brightest bloke in the world, but you know, I would have thought that if you're starting a hiring cycle, you should at least start to understand what your attrition looks like and roughly where you think you might need to have some hires this year. And it still amazes me the amount of organisations that don't do workforce planning particularly well. What I would say that I have seen is during the course of COVID, people actually starting to think about their workforce and the way that they are using people. And you know, there's a movement towards total talent management, you know, to blending temporary recruitment with permanent recruitment and thinking, actually, does this have to be a person in a particular work pattern? Or do we need a job to be done? Does it need to be a permanent? Could be a contract? How do we blend that? And I think that started to accelerate some of those thought processes. That's probably the only thing that I would say that I've seen coming out of COVID in that respect is people seem to be thinking about the workforce dynamic and the demographic of their workforce in a slightly different way, more so than their should they work at home or can they come back into the office. I kind of think that conversation's been done. We all kind of know there's going to be a level more flexibility. It's more about should they be employed permanently on a contract basis and actually when might do we need them? And that, again, is really interesting.
That's a fascinating thing to talk about. And I'm going to bring on a couple more guests to help us with that conversation. So, Rich and Mel, I'm going to thank you at this point. Please hang around with us and still keep talking with us on the chat stream because there's a bunch of questions I think it would be great for us to get you involved in. But I'm going to bring on Charlotte and John at this point. To take it from, you know, the customer point of view. Let's see what they say when it comes down to looking at RPO and their decisions to bring support in. So, Richard, thank you so much. Mel, thank you so much for your brilliant contribution.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Good to see you. Thanks.
By the way, folks, if you have any questions, please ask them and ask a question feature at the bottom of the screen. Scott, I've seen some of your questions there. I'm going to try and get to them, but with the chat stream moving fast, basically sometimes we can miss that. So I should have mentioned earlier, put it on the ask a question. Okay, let's bring on John Hull. He is, in fact, he can introduce himself in a bit. I'm going to bring on Charlotte as well. And then see where we're looking at from. Fascinating stuff. Hey, Alison, this is like, you know, I thought I knew a little, I knew I didn't know anything, to be honest with you. But I didn't know how much I didn't know, so to speak.
Yeah, you know what I'm finding really interesting is while you're bringing the others on is that, yeah, you know, I had a perception that RPO was still stuck in an old world. And actually listening to those two, this merging of strategic and workforce planning and RPO and talent intelligence, which is me and data, it feels like that's happening more quickly now than it ever has done before. So it feels like finally there is some genuine innovation happening.
Indeed. And a big overlap with what you do, actually, Alison, probably more so than we might have realized initially. Okay, we have Charlotte here. Charlotte, great to see you.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Charlotte, for the people who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself, like who you are, what it is you do?
I can indeed. So I'm Charlotte Nicholson, and I am currently doing a kind of hybrid career, actually. So part of my time, I am group head of talent acquisition for a business called Uniserve that are a logistics freight privately owned business. And then I'm also running my own consultancy that helps organizations with recruiting differently, whether that be on the operational delivery side or more on the strategic consulting side.
Fantastic. And it sounds like that type of experience, the combo of that would be perfect to join this conversation, Charlotte. I mean, there's no need for expertise here. Alice and I haven't got a clue about this. But it would be interesting to know, in your experience, like, have you engaged with RPOs before? And if so, you know, what kind of decision making do you need to make as a head of talent, even if you decided not to do it? Like, what was the why was that decision made?
So I've actually worked for an RPO, two actually, and I've also managed an RPO, and I've also exited an RPO, and I've also brought in an MSP. So I've kind of done a bit of everything. For me, I think goes back to what you were saying earlier, what the lady was saying earlier, that I've now forgotten her name, sorry, that was on. It's about what's the problem that the client's trying to solve or you're trying to solve. It's not, you mustn't RPO if you just think recruitment's too much of a hassle, I don't want anything to do with it, and therefore let's give the problem to somebody else.
That's the best reason, isn't it?
I think that's how it used to be, and that's where it then became a real challenge because there wasn't the partnership there. So it needs to be a strategic decision that it's the right thing for the business, would be my sort of advice, really. And that can be the whole piece, or it can be a particular module that we've talked about.
So how do you then make that win-win? Yeah, if it's a strategic decision, what are the kind of key factors that make that win-win for both parties?
Cost would obviously be a significant one. So, you know, there does need to be a financial benefit for both parties. I think in terms of the nature of what's required, it depends on so many dependents, really. If it's a startup, their focus has got to be driving sales. Therefore, recruitment is not a key priority for them in terms of an activity. So give it to somebody else who's the expertise. If internal talent is your key objective and moving talent around the organization, then probably RPO isn't the solution, because you want that internal branding EVP to be owned. So it needs to be, again, it links back to what are the key objectives and where is your priorities.
Is there a framework to help companies make that decision, Charlotte? Because it seems to me that might be useful to have some sort of, like, I wouldn't say a checklist, because that sort of diminishes what you need to do, but some sort of way to understand whether it's the right solution to make. Because I think anybody can be sold on the idea, but is it the optimal thing to do at that time? And, you know, it looks like, hearing from Mel and Rich, that the environment and the service offerings have become much more diverse. So suddenly the buying decision has become more complicated. Because, you know, again, back in the day, it was like, I want to get rid or not. That was the two choices, pretty binary. But now it's like, okay, I want to, this part maybe needs to come in. This part needs to be a software. This part is us, you know, all that type of stuff. It's a different type of decision making to make. But I assume there isn't a framework, right? Everyone's just going to try.
There isn't a framework. So I think if...
Oh, Mel's just said that RPOs themselves might offer a discovery audit. Fair enough.
I was going to say, so probably, you know, my advice would be to organizations that are contemplating something isn't working in their TA function and therefore they need to look at options, is to start small. So, you know, where is the priority? What is the burning platform? And give an organization a go. If it works, and it's not just about the output of the delivery, it's more about the partnerships and the relationships. If that works and you trust them, then you can go a bit more. And actually, I've seen that work, that grow. That's how it grows quite a lot, really, in terms of, oh, could you just do this and could you just do that? And the difference now, I think, is that RPOs are able to be more flexible around that kind of short-term modular piece that we've talked about, rather than these heavy contractual 3-5 year tenure contracts that tie you in and are very rigid. So that would be my advice, but it's a good idea for a framework. Maybe we can talk to Absco.
Yeah, like a vendor neutral a framework would be useful, right? I mean, a discovery audit from a vendor I think would be great, but obviously that's going to come with, you know, I wouldn't say suspicion, but you have to kind of understand, you know, they're selling a business. Yeah. But if there was an industry wide thing or something out there, open source, that you could just pick up and use, I think that would maybe trigger probably more purchasing decisions, I would guess.
Yeah.
Interesting you talk about the modularization is like a small entryway for RPO services, because it's terrifying to think you might be signing a contract that would just, you know, that's our recruitment apparently for the next 3 years, that's done. I can imagine that being like just your make or break decision for your career, never mind anybody else's. So what you want is the piecemeal type of thing. So maybe it's a case of identifying a sort of area that you want to recruit in, but you don't necessarily want to develop a long-term sourcing sort of approach there, at least not now, and then try one of these smaller modules coming in.
Yeah. Or it may be that you just, you know, you've got a project coming up that's a particular skill set that is going to be short term and is just going to be needed to deliver something that won't be a long-term part of your strategy. The diversity piece is an interesting one. I think it can be a dangerous way of just switching on an RPO to tick a few boxes around that piece, but to advise on some, you know, long-term solutions to really embed in the organization is key, because the problem with recruitment, as we've talked about, is the bus never stops. So some of these areas that are absolutely critical to an organization often are difficult to have that focus in a recruitment team when you've got to continue, you know, fulfillment is the number one priority for the day job. So I think, again, that's another area where it's useful to bring in that expertise that is absolutely dedicated, you know, has got a real key objective to hit, and comes in and does that and embeds some key solutions for you to then take forward.
The decisions that you've made as a RPO, can you tell us, like, where it has not gone perfectly? What were the reasons behind such a situation, Charlotte?
I think, number one is not being seen as an extension of you as an organization. So a very them and us relationship would be my number one. It doesn't work unless the RPO and the client are working hand in glove. And therefore transparency is key. So I've seen that, and I've also seen it where the client isn't clear on what we're buying. So we think we're buying one thing, and then you know when it all starts setting up, it's different. So be really clear on those requirements and how the RPO is meeting those requirements. The relationship partnership is probably the biggest killer where it doesn't work.
Yeah, and I think one of the benefits might be the fact that that there is a flow, isn't there, from people working RPO to working in-house, and the agency, people move around these spots. I think that's a good thing, because that can carry a relationship through sometimes. And as trust is one of those things that somebody has to trust first, almost. Otherwise, it doesn't work. So an adversarial attitude to an RPO is generally just going to crush people down on price, and you're going to end up with you're going to get what you pay for, basically. Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you sort of give advice to operational recruiters, Charlotte? So they haven't made the decision, right? They're just sitting there. An RPO is now part of the team. What do they need to do to build a good relationship? So, you know, they weren't party to the decision. They're just recruiting away. They've got support. And okay, great. Now, how do they behave then to these other people who are so-called part of the team? But, you know, you haven't met them before. You haven't dealt with that business before. Any tips?
Well, embrace it. So any recruiters that are given support and help, I would, you know, would embrace it. Don't see it as a threat. You'll actually learn from them because, you know, from me, from having worked for an RPO, you learn so much about governance, process, commercial side of things that, as well as, you know, real expertise, I guess. You can't know everything when you're in-house and if you haven't been on outsource side as well. So learn from them. Build up that relationship so that you work together. Just don't go in with an open mind. Don't go in with a closed mind of who's this person coming over and taking my role.
You know, the everyone's a recruiter, right? RPO, in-house agency, we're all kind of in the same sort of game, or at least we're looking at the same thing in maybe slightly different posture. Would you say there's different qualities associated with a great RPO recruiter compared to someone who's in-house? Or are they like directly interchangeable in your view? How do those things differ or are the same?
So I think, so take a step back. 8 to 10 years, a massive gap. So for me, in-house recruiters were very transactional and very admin heavy. And, you know, being honest, if you weren't any good in an agency, you thought, you know what, why don't I go in-house? It's an easier life. That's completely changed. And I think the RPO recruiter at that time was much more on the front foot in terms of the competitive edge, because there's a commercial contractual arrangement there. And I always used to say, I want that sort of external bite of an agency recruiter or an RPO recruiter in my in-house teams, because they still need to have that passion for getting a deal. which I have seen fall away from many, many recruiters. So I do think there was a gap, but I think as the talent acquisition functions within in-house now are getting much more sophisticated, that gap is closing, because the good TA, heads of TA, want those people that are the strong recruiters.
Yeah, there's definitely been a shift of balance and also perception, hasn't there? I would go even back 20 years, let's say, in-house, definitely, you know, it was perceived to be you're more or less the admin person, and agencies were the top dog, Big Brother, yeah, etc. You know, very machismo at the time, and now it's a role reversal largely, especially in big metropolitan centres where in-house recruiters, they're doing interesting projects, building great teams, you know, critical parts of businesses and so on. So very interesting to see how this goes. I just noticed the time, by the way. John's struggling to come on. I think we might struggle to bring him on due to tech issues, I'm afraid, John, to say, but we will make a correction on that next time. I definitely want John on in this show. But as we're running short on time, I'm just going to hit on a few final things. How do you measure performance of an RPO? Because we talk about being in a partnership and all that type of stuff. Oh shit. Not only have I sworn on TV, but I've also broken something, and Alison disappeared like at the same time. So like something strange happened in the universe right there.
What can you do to me then?
A glitch in the matrix. Okay, how do I measure an RPO? Because we want a win-win, but at the same time, are we still saying, look, we need you to deliver 5 seats every month or something per recruiter? How do we do that?
Yeah, so in the contract, there'll be a whole load of SLAs, KPIs that you'll agree that are the most important to you. My sort of advice there is keep it simple. Otherwise, the RPO will spend their life trying to prepare the metrics, and you'll spend your life trying to review them to see, you know, where the challenges are and what to improve on. But you'll have the SLAs, you'll have the KPIs, you'll have your monthly reviews, and that's all good. If your relationship is coming down to getting the contract out on the table every time you're sitting down to work out whether they're performing well or not, then that's not a good sign. It's the same as any relationship, really. You measure it on a daily basis by being with the team. Make yourself visible and present with the team. Don't be that person that doesn't only comes out for reviews. Scary client. Be visible with the team. Understand what they're doing. Be interested. Take their successes. Shout about them, but also work with them on areas that can be improved from the data that you're getting from them.
What is the duration? Is it typically open ended to say, look, here's the project, we're going to work together until it's done, or is there, because you mentioned you exited RPOs before, like, does it make sense to actually have an exit point to say, look, this team's here and helping us for the next 6 months, they're going to just help us sprint this way, then they're out of there. Like, what's your view on how do we put a time frame to it, or do we put a time frame to it?
I'd always put some kind of parameters on the solution, whether it's a short-term project, but I would probably do that more around output rather than necessarily a time scale. I think the longer-term contractual enterprise RPO end-to-end, then that needs to have an exit date and also a sort of review date as well.
Do you know, it sounds to me, it feels a bit weird that we're talking quite a lot about building a strategic relationship, but we're also talking about some quite short-term projects in some cases and modular RPO. And it'd be really interesting to see how those two factors kind of play out, particularly from a client perspective. Can you have a short-term tactical modular strategic relationship? And if you can, is that because you're just looking at a big tech stack? Yeah, I just think it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out.
That's a really good point. It's a bit of incongruence there in the sense that sometimes it is an emergency that where you haven't planned for it, you didn't intend for this to happen. You want a big contract, let's say, and you can't build a team in just for that one-off sort of 1 in 10 chance you got it. It lands for you, then suddenly you need to scale up. Then yeah, this is when you bring in. But that in itself might just be a tactical thing, like a fix rather than something you strategically plan. Let's go to the questions, folks, because we're running short on time. So Charlotte, you're gonna have to shoulder the weight for us on this. Just give these a shot as best you can. We've got one from Michael Blakely. He's saying, okay, what is the tipping point from going with one of the many embedded recruiters on offer to an RPO? Or is it purely a volume thing? So embedded recruiter, is that the same as an RPO or is it different? How does that work? I don't know.
Don't know.
You're going to have to answer the question as you've seen it, Charlotte. What are your thoughts? Is there a tipping point when you think RPO?
Is there a tipping point? Yes, there is a tipping. Well, so from a volume perspective, that's obviously a driver. So yeah, if you've got a team that is set out for 100 hires a year, and you suddenly get a project that's coming in that's going to be 100 hires in the next month, then yes, I would say that's a classic for bringing in a short-term project RPO piece.
Yep, fantastic. Okay, a couple more questions here from Mark. This is going to Rich, but Charlotte, you're going to have to take on the Rich mantle here. What business case would you advise or help collate to get the business buy-in for an RPO?
Great question.
Right, so... I think that there's probably three things there. It's cost. So are you, you know, you, you can pro- you, you, you probably your spend is through the roof on recruitment, whether that's through agency spend or your contingency labour force. I think it's the capability and that expertise and that ability to be sort of forward thinking on the front foot. You don't know what you don't know, right? So going to that market for that expertise. And I think it's possibly a shift in skill set as well. If your organization is transforming, then you need a change of direction in how you're going to acquire that.
I think we should ask Mel, as part of their role, to be doing a bit like the tip sheet series that we talked about that we did home. I think there needs to be a tip sheet for people who are looking at RPO, which is, what's your business problem? Yeah, kind of a blank template for the questions to ask, and then a tip sheet for gaining buy-in from your business leaders. It sounds like an awesome set of things now to be working on.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know what that is, whether there is a plan for action there. But I think that I wonder how much education the market does actually need on this, because you know, if there's a bunch of people that have never worked with RPO and they have to make the decision for the first time, you know, a bit more confidence on those people will actually trigger a lot more deals. Okay, that's about it, folks. I think that we've learned a huge amount, much more to talk about with this topic, actually. We haven't talked about this alternative rise of alternative work, for instance, which Rich mentioned earlier. I do think the shift to remote might have more legs to it as a conversation, like how do you open up different markets, for instance. Oftentimes, your internal TA team can deal with recruiting locally, but if you're now recruiting globally, how do you do that? You might not have the skill set to do it. So you might want to engage a wider business to do it. So lots of things to talk about. Maybe time to do a part two on RPOs, and we'll get John back for that if we can. Anyway, Charlotte, thank you for joining us with your insight. It's been fantastic having you on the show.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
We'll get you back another time, Charlotte.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
How interesting was that conversation? It's so fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really interesting because, A, there's been more... It almost feels like a dichotomy. On the one hand, there's part of me that's saying there's been a whole bunch more innovation in that sector than I had given it credit for. And yet, on the other hand, there's also this part that says, actually, it's getting a bit confused because there's a bit of outsourcing that's now becoming modular and tactical. Yeah, and that kind of strategic and tactical thing. So it was really interesting to hear that, I think.
Well, again, I don't want to tell you your business, Alice, I wouldn't dare do that. But I wonder if this idea of all we're doing a modular service, like the stuff that you do at Talent Intuition, I wonder whether it might actually slide into one of those modules, so to speak, to say, oh, look, you need to do some talent mapping, or you need to understand, you know, what's happening in this global marketplace that we're now needing to recruit on. You don't have the internal capacity for that. Your business as usual recruiters are flat out business as usual. So, you know, they don't have that extra space. So that potentially is a function for either a business like yours or a mega corp that has a unit that does something similar. So exciting times to be a RPO. I wonder whether we're using old terminology. I certainly am, because it might not be right to call them process outsourcers in the same way. Which does strike me as very cost-driven, very much just get rid of the pay, you know, get rid of the payroll, get rid of all that admin stuff. This is like, yeah, you just need to have a very flexible, multidisciplinary service that can help you in all kinds of ways to position for talent.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think it was really, really good guests.
They were, and John, I'm really sorry I couldn't get you on the show. There was just like a browser issue there, and also some security stuff. John works for Nationwide, and I should have checked that. No, he was actually waiting, so I do apologize. John Hall's awesome. So we have to get John on another time, but I think Crowdcast will not like the Safari iPad combo, so we might need to find a time that makes that work for John. So John, my apologies to everyone who wanted to see John Hall. We'll get him on another time. Okay, that's about it. I'm going to let everyone go. You have a good weekend. Enjoy your weekend. Mine starts more or less now because I ain't working Friday afternoon. And we'll be back next week. If you enjoyed this type of conversation, by the way, follow the channel because we do this every Friday, folks. Next week is going to be even more interesting. Why? We're talking about quantifying company culture. Can you measure it? Can you count? What can you count in culture that makes the difference? Let's start talking about the airy-fairy stuff. We're going to apply some metrics to company culture. It's going to be amazing. We're going to bring on a lot of organizational psychology people. We're going to bring on some anthropology people. We're going to bring on some all kinds of, you know, additional thinking from outside of TA. So it's going to be amazing. All right. That's about it, folks. You have a good weekend. We'll see you soon.
Have a great weekend.
Cool. Let's end broadcast, Alison. Thank you, by the way, for stepping in. I think we can agree an upgrade on Adam Gordon. So you're welcome back. By the way, as an aside, a couple of things you're doing, right? Doing the 20 questions. But you're also, I do want to talk about the vulnerability and leadership thing. So once I figure out when to set that up, I'll set it up and then we'll get you on to talk about that. Because I think that's an in, because you've been in that position at the top. And it's, I think, very interesting to explore, you know, what is the line, because we need to understand that as we.
And there's something, there's something really interesting about it being in a startup and then a leadership and then a corporate. Yeah, and I've kind of done all of those bits, and you have to be different in each of them.
Like, absolutely. Really, I think we're overly critical sometimes of corporate control of comms, but I mean, there's a reason why, you know, recruiters from Facebook haven't turned up to Brain Food Live yet. It's because they're not allowed to, and that rightly so, because it's a live show, anything can happen, and, you know, something can happen and the entire business might suffer for that. So
when you said on camera, there you go.
You know what happened? I knocked over the Alexa at the same time as losing you. You disappeared off camera, and then something else happened. It was like three things that, like, in 1 second. I thought, whoa, glitch in the matrix. All right, anyway, I'll let you go. You have a good weekend,
and you too. Take care.
See you later.
Bye.
Cool. Scott, I think we didn't get to your question. I do apologize. We'll get to it next time, bro. All right. Enjoy your weekend, folks.